one of the things I focused on here, I've pointed out in other things that I've written, the strong connection that I see between the name Nephi and Egyptian Nefer, which, you know, one of the main adjectival forms by Lehi's time. And that word was understood meaning good or goodly, fair. So the Nephites, it makes sense that they might have come to see themselves in terms of concepts of being good. And I think this plays out to the end.
Hello, and welcome to Conversations with the Interpreter, where we look at projects and papers from the Interpreton Foundation. I am Avram Shannon.
And I am Thora Shannon. Our guest for today is Matthew L. Bowen. Dr. Bowen has a PhD in Biblical Studies from the Catholic University of America. He is a professor and the director of religious education at Brigham Young University, Hawaii. He has published numerous studies on ancient wordplay and naming in the Book of Mormon. And thanks for being here, Matt.
Thank you, Thora. Thank you, Avram.
We're glad to have you. On today's show, we're looking at Matt's article, Inspired by a Better Cause, The Function of Alma 44-45 in Mormon's account of the monarchic wars against the Nephites. And this is available in The Interpreter, a journal of Latter-day Saint faith and scholarship. So as you kind of think through what you're doing, so what was kind of your goal as you wrote this article?
You know, it's interesting. The goal actually shifted over time. And this would be an appropriate time, I think, to give a shout out to Rebecca Lambert, who was the editor, the one editor I was working with on this paper and on the Halam paper. She really pressed me on this. She asked a lot of really good questions to make sure I was considering all of the possible angles on this. And so it kind of shifted. I had kind of been thinking, you know, we'll look at this, this verse that may have some onomastic implications in terms of how we understand the Nephites, Lamanites, their cause. And then it widened into a broader consideration of, well, what is a Nephite or a Lamanite at this period of time?
Yeah.
You know, what are Amalekites or Amalekites more likely here? You know, what's the, it's clearly that it's gone far beyond any kind of ethnic specific designation for the most part at this point, right?
Yeah, oh,
absolutely. These terms become much more socio-political and really largely political and even religious in terms of what they describe or define.
Because, of course, one thing the Book of Mormon is very clear, that's hard for us sometimes as moderns, is that in antiquity, the divisions we make between religion and politics are not nearly as strong.
That's right.
They're non-existent, actually.
That's right. We sort of make categorical distinctions that they didn't make. And that's important to remember. The British had a taxonomy of the way they looked at people, you know, during the colonial period, that has largely affected the way we still see people and describe them. And that's not really how they looked at things in the ancient world.
Yeah, that's great.
So can you, let's look at actually the verses you really go over for this paper.
Sure.
First, so we can really use that as our basis. So if you're at home, we're reading in Alma 43, 44, and 45, like the title talks about. And if we could look there, and then really, if you could unpack for us some of this Nephite and Hebrew origins that we might be getting out of these groups.
Yeah.
For the names of the groups.
And so the Lamanite forces, beginning in 44, and they were inspired by the Zoramites and the Amalekites, who were their chief captains and leaders, and by Zerahemnah, who was their chief captain or their chief leader and commander. Yea, they did fight like dragons, and many of the Nephites were slain by their hands. Yea, they did smite in two many of their headplates, and they did pierce many of their breastplates, and they did smite off many of their arms. And thus the Lamanites did smite in their fierce anger. Nevertheless, the Nephites were inspired by a better cause, for they were not fighting for monarchy nor power, but they were fighting for their homes and their liberties and their wives and their children and their all. Yea, for their rites of worship and their church. So one of the things I focused on here, or a couple of the things, first, I've pointed out in other things that I've written the strong connection that I see between the name Nephi and what I think is the strongest etymological source in Egyptian Nefer, which, you know, one of the main adjectival forms by Lehi's time, the third R in the root has weakened considerably. So they're pronouncing it something like Nephi, Nephi, Nufi. And
seems to point directly then.
Yes. And that word was understood, and the lexicons all describe it this way, as meaning good or goodly, fair. So the Nephites, I mean, that it makes sense that they might have come to see themselves in terms of concepts of being good. And I think this plays out to the very end when Mormon is lamenting the destruction of the Nephites, when he says, "Oh, ye fair ones," and he, in repetition, he emphasized that, "Oh, ye fair sons and daughters."
The article is also an interpreter and also worth a read, but
thank you.
I think you could even say that in the beginning, right? Nephi is like, I, Nephi, good.
Good,
goodly parents.
Born of goodly parents. In fact, that's where it started. I was in a class with Dr. Gee, John Gee, who's been one of my mentors. And I pointed this out, and he stopped class and he said, "That's really good." And after class, he said, "You should write up something on that." And that's sort of where it all started, right? And I had noticed that, and some of the association with the name Nephi and good and Helaman 5. You remember the Helaman's dialogue with his sons. And those things came to me, oddly enough, sitting in sacrament meeting, or fast and testimony meeting, watching one of my friends share testimony. And it's odd, the timing of some of these things when they hit you, but that's what happened.
I had a paper once come to me. It was in Columbus, Ohio. So it was a small temple, and I was an ordnance worker, and I was working the front desk. And I had one about guarded space there and whatever, but same thing. We're just standing there like, "Oh, I guess, okay."
That was a great paper, by the way.
Well, thank you.
But yeah, so the Nephites, you know, so this is good. And then can you talk some about like what the Amalekites are? Actually, first, tell us about Amalekites, Amlicites, or like what that connection is?
Yeah, I'll say something about that in a second. But I should point out that in Hebrew and Egyptian, you don't form, there isn't a word for better. So when it says better cause,
that's important.
You have to say it's contextual in many cases. It's good.
Then something. Right?
Yeah, exactly. And so they have ways of forming comparatives and giving you a sense, but that there wasn't. So what Mormon seems to be doing here is saying the Nephite cause is the morally good cause, right? And then he explains why. But then this is also where Hebrew and Semitic languages are relevant, because one of the things you get starting in the very beginning of the Book of Alma, when the Amalekites first come on the scene, you have these two in the Book of Alma. You have Amalekai and you have later Amalekiah, who are these monarchic usurpers. And you have to think that they're thinking of both of these individuals in terms of the Hebrew Semitic concept of Malak, to rule, to reign as king, to become king. I mean, the word Melech means king, the gendered feminine equivalent is Malkah.
Which is probably why, and you already said it this, but for our viewers at home, probably why Amalekai is actually a better pronunciation than Amlesai.
Yeah.
Because it, that sus sound wouldn't be, it wouldn't, it, it's not the same root there.
Yeah. So. And I know that not every scholar agrees on this, but I think that...
You're on this call right now, so all I care right now is what you think. So.
We absolutely agree with this.
Right. So, I think that the biblical name Amalek is not one Nephites would have, or Lamanites would have given their children, probably, but a Melech-derived name. But those are...
Amalek would be weird, yeah.
Yeah, those are, beginning with, we talk about Moloch or Melech or Muloch in the Book of Mormon, who is an important ancestor of many of the people in the Book of Mormon, part of the Davidic royal line. And those issues, I don't go into great depth on that in this paper, but other scholars have talked about this, and I've discussed this elsewhere, that the, there are sort of these latent issues of whose right is it to rule that are really boiling to the surface during this period of time. It starts with Amalekai, but who may or may not have been a descendant of Muloch, and other, this has been talked about in Interpreter and elsewhere.
Yeah, Brent Garza's got some good stuff with this. I mean, you get that weird verse where they tell us the only Nephites get to be kings, and you're like, but why? What's going on? What's going on here with that?
Right. And the issue of the right to rule, right? I mean, a descendant of David would have read texts, scriptural texts, differently, especially with respect to issues like that, than maybe descendants of Nephi who weren't.
Yeah. But
at a point there, at some time after the time of Mosiah too, they really start to blend together, and some of them would have shared both heritages. But the issue of who gets to call the shots, who gets to reign, who gets to rule.
And in some ways, as you point out very nicely, that's like one of the huge themes in the whole Book of Alma, right? This question of, as you said, start with Amlesai, Amalekiah, kingmen.
And Melchizedek is...
right there in the center. Yeah.
And that's, Alma's talking about Melchizedek to people who had been, they were also of the religion of Nehor, so they would have been allied with Amalekai and his goals.
Yeah.
So that we got this, I think the verb Malak, the Hebrew concept of Malak, to rule, to reign, to become king, and to be king. And Melech is, it's really important to understanding some fundamental things going on in this book.
Oh, absolutely. The kingmen just keep coming up and coming up again and again. And it's clear that this is an ongoing difficulty in Nephite society. Well, Nephite now combined with Zarahemlai, which of course are these descendants of Moloch. So you have this real dissatisfied undercurrent. I mean, I you're right. Under King Benjamin, most of them do combine, but there's definitely some.
It doesn't erase all differences, right? And that's true. It's interesting. In Laie, where I live and teach, we've got people from all over the Pacific, Asia Rim, continental United States. A lot of intermarriage. But, a lot of the cultural distinctions, people still kind of stick to a lot of that. I mean, there's a real persistence of those things that sometimes we think, oh, that'll be gone in a generation. But it's not. I mean, late in the Book of Mosiah, Mosiah the Second is, I mean, King Benjamin had to address two
people specifically,
And this was just a generation after his father, right? When they had combined the people. But that still seems to be going on at the end of the Book of Mosiah as well.
Yeah. And you see it even, I'd argue, and you kind of point this out, the part you do this, even as you get into the Lamanites, that Ammon's brothers show up and they're still divided in their groups. They're still, and Lamoni's father lets them do their religious thing, we do our religious thing, but it's still clearly these identities. Even though they're all Lamanites now, they're clearly now, there's still Amalekites or Amalekites and whatever.
Zoramites.
And Zoramites, even within that broader identity.
And that's exactly why it's worth looking at. Okay, what do we mean? And Mormon does some of this. He defines who he describes as Christians,
right,
or the people of God. And so he tries to get, you know, kind of adjust the way some of these terms are applied, because the Lamanites by this point have a lot of Nephite descenders who are a part of, who support their political goals.
And who even running them? I mean,
yeah.
I really like to call it the monarchic war. I've jokingly told Avram it's really not the Nephite Lamanite war. It's the Nephite and Nephite dissenter war.
Yeah, that's really what it is. I mean, they're not fighting for monarchy, this Melech concept in verse 44, but instead the cause, you know, it's supposed to be the better cause, the good cause, which when Mormon describes it here, it's very close to what he describes as the cause of Christians in another passage.
Yeah, we can really see how, I mean, even in this description, how you can see that obviously Lamanites are involved, but the leaders, right, were all these dissenter Nephites who wanted to be kings or kingmen. And you can see that really driving a lot of the motivation for this war and the movement for the war.
Who has power? That's not an irrelevant concept in 2026, right?
Not at all.
The issue of who has power and the right to use it. Well, you know, the Lord had the Savior, Jesus Christ, had some very specific things that he said about that, and expectations that have claim on his disciples or those who claim to be his disciples.
And I think I like to bring that out because this is sort of the beginning of the war chapters, and sometimes, you know, we'll tell the war chapters and we'll sort of spiritualize them. Well, it's about like warfare with the devil, and those are all great.
You can apply.
Yeah. It's not to diminish those as readings, but I think part of what we're pointing out here, what you're pointing out here, is no, actually, for Mormon, this has spiritual significance that we're talking about. These wars are not just, it's not just Mormon suddenly like fell off the deep end as I just do hysteria all the time here, that he is framing these in these ways, the better cause, the Christian cause, the church of God, the people of God, because this war is actually a war that has spiritual significance.
Right.
So can we move back in time for a minute? In your paper, you talk about Jacob and how he is already using, like contrasting the Nephites and the Lamanites. Can you talk a little bit about that, that you look at in the book of Jacob?
Well, you know, when we're really young kids, we just think Nephites, good guys, Lamanites, bad guys, when almost from the beginning, that's not how we're supposed to see these things. Jacob had some very pointed critiques of the Nephites and their approach to family. I've got a colleague at BYU Hawaii who's writing up a great paper on this issue, the generational consequences of the Lamanites' faithfulness in terms of family relationships.
Yeah,
This is when it's done, I'm really excited that he's doing this. This is my colleague, Aaron Shumway. It's going to be great. But so while the Nephites on a certain level, they aren't delinquent as a people from the religious practices that are expected of the covenant people, while the Lamanites are. But the Lamanites are far more faithful at that point in terms of their family relationships. Well, now, you know, we look at verse 45, and vis-a-vis the cause of monarchy in 44, you've got this better cause, which is very, very family centric. that how much of this, because now we don't understand Nephites, is just this sort of old ethnic Nephi idea.
Yeah.
This got the Nephites now includes a lot of
Lamanites.
Former Lamanites, right?
The anti-Nephi Lehis, who are now the people of Ammon.
But how much has this group influenced the focus on family?
That's a great point.
One of the things that I was just pointing out for something that Thor and I are looking at doing in the future together is this notion that almost all the, frankly, women and mothers who are, mentioned and called in the Book of Mormon are Lamanites, converted Lamanites. Like it's a major feature of their culture in ways that seems to be, as you point out, a little bit different, we see from the Nephites, historical Nephites.
You see King Lamoni, but then I call her Queen Lamoni. We don't have her name. The wife of King Lamoni, you have Abish, their servant, and it talks about, her being converted by a vision of her father. You have the Queen Mother.
Yeah. Lamoni's father. Yeah.
And they're all really important people in the narrative, how it unfolds. In fact, they're crucial.
And of course, you also then have the mothers of the stripling warriors.
Right.
Like we do know our mothers knew this. I think this is a great observation. It does seem to be something that the converted Lamanites are bringing into Nephite civilization in really fun ways.
And, this idea that the Nephites, the so-called ethnic Nephites, or traditionally ethnic Nephites, had some corner on goodness is an absurdity, right? And that's the point. The better cause here has nothing to do with ethnicity. It has everything to do with the focus. It isn't on power, on the issue of political power and who has the...
Who's about to make decisions and things
who
like
gets
that.
Who gets to wield the big stick. It's we're fighting for home, liberty, family, children.
Their right to
worship.
Yeah. Which is definitely, a much pure motivation.
And vulnerable, too, right?
Yeah.
I mean, these are things that they don't just... I'm thinking of this U2 song suddenly. Love has got to fight for its existence. It's fragile. It doesn't just... the things we take for granted sometimes, we just think that they're always going to be there because... Anyone of good sense would think they're important, but that's not true.
History has shown us very strongly that that's absolutely not true.
1930s Germany, we both have Jewish family.
Yeah.
Who...
Actually, Thor's stepdad is Jewish also, so we all have Jewish families.
Things that at the beginning of the decade... People thought
unthinkable,
right. Unimaginable, or suddenly horrifyingly real in the most astonishing, appalling ways by the end of the latter end of the 30s, and then as the Holocaust ramps up in the 40s, unspeakable.
And you can really see that one. I'm going to bring that up. You can really see. In the Book of Mormon, that same thing happening. Where, as an example of this, you mentioned, Ammonihah, and they were Nahorites. They probably supported Amalekai, whatever. And they go from a theological question, why is your church right and my church wrong, or whatever, to burning women and children to make a point,
right?
And I'm sure because. People are like this. They didn't start following Nehor saying we're going to end by burning women and children. But sometimes it gets with the identity or the cause becomes the most important thing there.
Right. It never starts with that level of inhumanity. But when we allow dehumanizing to ramp up, it always, that's the where it inevitably leads.
And we can see at the end of the Book of Mormon, too. I mean, some of the final chapters of the Book of Mormon are just wrenching, not at the end when Moroni is talking, but, when they're describing what the Lamanites are doing, and then they're like, but the Nephites are doing even worse. And of course, by this point, they're 100% just chosen identities, because after Jesus Christ came, of course, they all combined. So this is just choosing, but neither identity at this point is choosing righteousness.
And in fact, I'm struck by, I think it's one of the most chilling statements in Mormon's letter to his son, Moroni, the second one. You know, that second letter, when he says they've lost their, he says first that they'd lost their love one towards another, but he said that the Nephites had come to delight in everything save that which is good. Remember?
Yeah.
Nephites associate themselves with what's good or fair and, you know, good quality, fine, so forth. And they've become not just not that, but they're far worse than the Lamanites at the end. And the Lord still extends, I talked about this yesterday at Sperry, the chesed is available to some who are just less depraved than the other.
And I think, and this is hard, but I think it's important. Sometimes we talk about the Book of Mormon being written for our day, you know, it kind of makes us feel good about things and, you know, we have the scripture written for us. But sometimes I think the Book of Mormon's written for our day. Again, Moroni says, so you can be smarter than we were.
That's exactly right. That's 100% correct.
So when we think about this kind of tribalism, we think about this kind of, you know, what we're talking about here, this us versus them mentality, the Book of Mormon says, there's one end to that road.
That's right. And it furnishes two witnesses of it. Remember, it's not just what happens to the Nephites, it's what had happened to the Jaredites. The Nephites are an Israelite group. The Jaredites are, I think, and there's a lot of textual support for this, would, you know, Mormon and Moroni think of them in terms of Gentiles.
Yeah.
But this happens to, so this is a witness and a warning, to use President Benson's language, to everybody, that this is where pride, anger, hardening one's heart, and then doing so to such a degree that you dehumanize people, that's where it leads.
So before we end, so we don't have very much time left, but I wanted to go from one hard topic to another hard topic. I feel like this understanding of Nephi being like the word meaning good, and even talk about fair meaning good, right? Can I think also help with sometimes when people are talking about the Book of Mormon, they look at the Book of Mormon and they say, but it's so racist because they talk about the Nephites being fair and the Lamanites not. And I think understanding this is not a description of a ethnic
or
racial thing. I mean, for one thing, they come from the same stock. Like, they can't look that different from each other.
That's right.
But really realizing that this is a description of their following the covenants or not, not a description of race, which I think is helpful for when reading the Book of Mormon. We don't need to insert problems that aren't
there. And I mentioned the British taxonomy.
Yeah.
That's kind of conditioned us to think of race in ways, the kind of ways we typically do in society now, but they didn't do that then. And so it's important not to impose, you know, a modern taxonomic lens on viewing race and ethnicity in among Book of Mormon peoples in the same way that we would. We have to understand that they would have seen it differently. And so what might strike us as racially charged language used by Jacob or Mormon, for example, or even Nephi, that it would have come across differently and been understood differently to among other ancient people.
Yeah, good. Thanks. And I think that's a good reminder to us, from the Article of Faith 13, and kind of continuing the pun here, that what God wants us to do is do good to all men.
Right.
That's the whole point of the gospel, Jesus Christ.
I teach the, and maybe you've had this experience, I get to teach a Pearl of Great Price class.
My favorite class.
And I always love it when, because there's, all of the articles of faith are great. But I always love it when I ask them what their favorite one is. And I always love it when they pick 13.
I will often end my classes at the end of the semester and say, look, guys, this is it. Let's go out and let's do some good.
Yep. I love it.
Okay. Thanks for being with us today, Matt.
Thank you. Thora, thank you, Avram.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of Conversations with Interpreter. To read the articles and scholarship discussed today, visit interpreterfoundation.org. Be sure to subscribe and share this episode with others who seek learning by study and by faith.